is a form of pretense, too, our being too casual. It makes things more important, not less, doesn't it? Let's say whatever we wish. I love you, he said, his voice expressionless, as if the words were a statement of pain, and not addressed to her. I'm glad to be back with you, Gail. I didn't know I would be, but I'm glad.
In what way, Dominique?
I don't know. In a way of contagion from you, I think. In a way of finality and peace.
Then they noticed that this was said in the middle of a crowded platform with people in baggage racks hurrying past. They walked out to the street, to his car. She did not ask where they were going, and did not care. She sat silently beside him. She felt divided, most of her swept by a wish not to resist, and a small part of her left to wonder about it. She felt a desire to let him carry her, a feeling of confidence without appraisal, not a happy confidence, but confidence. After a while she noticed that her hand lay in his, the length of her gloved fingers held to the length of his, only the spot of her bare wrist pressed to his skin. She had not noticed him take her hand. It seemed so natural, and what she had wanted from the moment of seeing him. But she would not allow herself to want it.
"Where are we going, Gail?" she asked.
"To get the license, then to the judge's office, to be married." She sat up slowly, turning to face him. She did not withdraw her hand, but her fingers became rigid, conscious, taken away from him.
"No," she said.
She smiled, and held the smile too long, in deliberate, fixed precision. He looked at her calmly.
"I want a real wedding, Gail. I want it at the most ostentatious hotel in town. I want engraved invitations, guests, mobs of guests, celebrities, flowers, flashbulbs, and newsreel cameras. I want the kind of wedding the public expects of Gail Winant."
He released her fingers, simply, without resentment. He looked abstracted for a moment, as if he were calculating a problem in arithmetic, not too difficult. Then he said, "All right. That will take a week to arrange. I could have done it tonight, but if it's engraved invitations, we must give the guests a week's notice at the least. Otherwise it would look abnormal, and you want a normal Gail Winant wedding. I'll have to take you to a hotel now where you can live for a week. I had not planned for this, so I've made no reservations. Where would you like to stay?"
"At your penthouse?"
"No."
"The Nordland, then."
He leaned forward and said to the chauffeur, "The Nordland, John." In the lobby of the hotel, he said to her, "I will see you a week from today, Tuesday, at the Noyes Belmont at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The invitations will have to be in the name of your father. Let him know that I'll get in touch with him. I'll attend to the rest." He bowed, his manner unchanged, his calm still holding the same peculiar quality made of two things. The mature control of a man so certain of his capacity for control that it could seem casual. And a childlike simplicity of accepting events as if they were subject to no possible change. She did not see him during that week. She found herself waiting impatiently. She saw him again when she stood beside him, facing the judge who pronounced the words of the marriage ceremony over the silence of 600 people in the floodlighted ballroom of the Noyes Belmont Hotel. The background, she had wished, was set so perfectly that it became its own caricature, not a specific society wedding, but an impersonal prototype of lavish, exquisite vulgarity. He had understood her wish and obeyed scrupulously. He had refused himself the relief of exaggeration. He had not staged the event crudely, but made it beautiful in the exact manner Gail Winant, the publisher, would have chosen had he wished to be married in public. But Gail Winant did not wish to be married in public. He made himself fit the setting, as if he were part of the bargain, subject to the same style. When he entered, she saw him looking at the mob of guests as if he did not realize that such a mob was appropriate to a grand opera premiere or a royal rummage sale, not to the solemn climax of his life. He looked correct, incomparably distinguished. Then she stood with him, the mob becoming a heavy silence and a gluttonous stare behind him, and they faced the judge together. She wore a long black dress with a bouquet of fresh jasmine, his present, attached by a black band to her wrist. Her face, in the halo of a black lace hat, was raised to the judge, who spoke slowly, letting his words hang one by one in the air. She glanced at Wynand. He was not looking at her nor at the judge. Then she knew that he was alone in that room. He held this moment, and he made of it, of the glare, of the vulgarity, a silent height of his own. He had not wished a religious ceremony which he did not respect, and he could have less respect for the state's functionary reciting a formula before him. But he made the rite an act of pure religion. She thought, if she were being married to Rourke in such a setting, Rourke would stand like this. Afterward, the mockery of the monster reception that followed left him immune. He posed with her for the battery of press cameras, and he complied gracefully with all the demands of the reporters, a special noisier mob within the mob. He stood with her in the receiving line, shaking an assembly belt of hands that unrolled past them for hours. He looked untouched by the lights, the haystacks of Easter lilies, the sounds of a string orchestra, the river of people flowing on and breaking into a delta when it reached the champagne. Untouched by these guests who had come here driven by boredom, by an envious hatred, a reluctant submission to an invitation bearing his dangerous name, a scandal-hungry curiosity. He looked as if he did not know that they took his public immolation as their rightful due, that they considered their presence as the indispensable seal of sacrament upon the occasion, that of all the hundreds, he and his bride were the only ones to whom the performance was hideous. She watched him intently. She wanted to see him take pleasure in all this, if only for a moment. Let him accept and join, just once, she thought. Let him show the soul of the New York Banner in its proper element. She saw no acceptance. She saw a hint of pain at times. Even the pain did not reach him completely. And she thought of the only other man she knew who had spoken about suffering that went down only to a certain point. When the last congratulations had drifted past them, they were free to leave by the rules of the occasion. But he made no move to leave. She knew he was waiting for her decision. She walked away from him into the current of guests. She smiled, bowed, and listened to offensive nonsense, a glass of champagne in her hand. She saw her father in the throng. He looked proud and wistful. He seemed bewildered. He had taken the announcement of her marriage quietly. He had said, "I want you to be happy, Dominique. I want it very much. I hope he's the right man." His tone had said that he was not certain. She saw Ellsworth Toohey in the crowd. He noticed her looking at him and turned away quickly. She wanted to laugh aloud, but the matter of Ellsworth Toohey caught off guard did not seem important enough to laugh about now. Alva Skerritt pushed his way toward her. He was making a poor effort at a suitable expression, but his face looked hurt and sullen. He muttered something rapid about his wishes for her happiness, but then he said distinctly, and with a lively anger, "But why, Dominique? Why?" She could not quite believe that Alva Skerritt would permit himself the crudeness of what the question seemed to mean. She asked coldly, "What are you talking about, Alva?"
"The veto, of course."
"What veto?"
"You know very well what veto. Now I ask you, with every sheet in the city here, every damn one of them, the lousiest tabloid included, and the wire services, too. Everything but the Banner. Everything but the Wynand papers. What am I to tell people? How am I to explain? Is that a thing for you to do to a former comrade of the trade?"
"You'd better repeat that, Alva."
"You mean you didn't know that Gale wouldn't allow a single one of our boys here? That we won't have any stories tomorrow? Not a spread, not a picture? Nothing but two lines on page 18?
"No," she said. "I didn't know it."
He wondered at the sudden jerk of her movement as she turned away from him. She handed the champagne glass to the first stranger in sight, whom she mistook for a waiter. She made her way through the crowd to Wynand.
"Let's go, Gale."
"Yes, my dear."
She stood incredulously in the middle of the drawing room of his penthouse, thinking that this place was now her home, and how right it looked to be her home.
He watched her. He showed no desire to speak or touch her, only to observe her here, in his house, brought here, lifted high over the city. As if the significance of the moment were not to be shared, not even with her. She moved slowly across the room, took off her hat, leaned against the edge of a table. She wondered why her normal desire to say little, to hold things closed, broke down before him, why she felt compelled to simple frankness, such as she could offer no one else. "You've had your way after all, Gale. You were married as you wanted to be married."
"Yes, I think so."
"It was useless to try to torture you."
"Actually, yes. But I didn't mind it too much."
"You didn't?"
"No. If that's what you wanted, it was only a matter of keeping my promise."
"But you hated it, Gale."
"Utterly."
"What of it?"
"Only the first moment was hard, when you said it in the car. Afterward, I was rather glad of it."
He spoke quietly, matching her frankness. She knew he would leave her the choice. He would follow her manner. He would keep silent or admit anything she wished to be admitted.
"Why?" "Didn't you notice your own mistake? If it was a mistake. You wouldn't have wanted to make me suffer if you were completely indifferent to me."
"No, it was not a mistake."
"You're a good loser, Dominique."
"I think that's also contagion from you, Gale. And there's something I want to thank you for."
"What?"
"That you barred our wedding from the wine and papers." He looked at her, his eyes alert in a special way for a moment. Then he smiled.
"It's out of character. You're thanking me for that."
"It was out of character for you to do it."
"I had to. But I thought you'd be angry."
"I should have been. But I wasn't. I'm not."
"I thank you." "Can one feel gratitude for gratitude?" "It's a little hard to express, but that's what I feel, Dominique."
She looked at the soft light on the walls around her. That lighting was part of the room, giving the walls a special texture of more than material or color. She thought that there were other rooms beyond these walls, rooms she had never seen, which were hers now. And she found that she wanted them to be hers. "Gale, I haven't asked what we are to do now. Are we going away? Are we having a honeymoon?" "Funny, I haven't even wondered about it. I thought of the wedding and nothing beyond, as if it stopped there and you took over from then on." "Also out of character, Gale?"
"But not in my favor this time. Passivity is not a good sign, not for you."
"It might be, if I'm glad of it."
"Might. Though it won't last." "No, we're not going anywhere. Unless you wish to go."
"No."
"Then we stay here." Another peculiar manner of making an exception. The proper manner for you and me. Going away has always been running, for both of us. This time, we don't run.
"Yes, Gale."
When he held her and kissed her, her arm lay bent, pressed between her body and his, her hand at her shoulder. And she felt her cheek touching the faded jasmine bouquet on her wrist, its perfume still intact, still a delicate suggestion of spring. When she entered his bedroom, she found that it was not the place she had seen photographed in countless magazines. The glass cage had been demolished. The room built in its place was a solid vault without a single window. It was lighted and air-conditioned, but neither light nor air came from the outside. She lay in his bed, and she pressed her palms to the cold, smooth sheet at her sides. Not to let her arms move and touch him. But her rigid indifference did not drive him to helpless anger. He understood. He laughed. She heard him say, his voice rough, without consideration, amused, "It won't do, Dominique." And she knew that this barrier would not be held between them, that she had no power to hold it. She felt the answer in her body. An answer of hunger, of acceptance, of pleasure. She thought that it was not a matter of desire, not even a matter of the sexual act, but only that man was the life force and woman could respond to nothing else, that this man had the will of life, the prime power, and this act was only its simplest statement, and she was responding not to the act nor to the man, but to that force within him.
"Well?" asked Ellsworth Toohey.
"Now do you get the point?"
He stood leaning informally against the back of Skerritt's chair, and Skerritt sat staring down at a hamper full of mail by the side of his desk.
"Thousands," sighed Skerritt. "Thousands, Ellsworth. You ought to see what they call him. Why didn't he print the story of his wedding? What's he ashamed of? What's he got to hide? Why didn't he get married in church like any decent man? How could he marry a divorcee? That's what they're all asking. Thousands. And he won't even look at the letters. Gail Winand, the man they call the seismograph of public opinion."
"That's right," said Toohey. "That kind of a man."
"Here's a sample."
Skerritt picked up a letter from his desk and read aloud.
"I'm a respectable woman and mother of 5 children, and I certainly don't think I want to bring up my children with your newspaper. Have taken the same for 14 years, but now that you show that you're the kind of man that has no decency in making a mockery of the holy institution of marriage, which is to commit adultery with a fallen woman, also another man's wife, who gets married in a black dress, as she jolly well ought to, I won't read your newspaper any more, as you're not a man fit for children, and I'm certainly disappointed in you. Very truly yours, Mrs. Thomas Parker." I read it to him. He just laughed.
"Uh-huh," said Toohey.
"What's got into him?"
"It's nothing that got into him, Alva. It's something that got out at last."
"By the way, did you know that many papers dug up their old pictures of Dominique's nude statue from that goddamn temple and ran it right with the wedding story? To show Mrs. Winand's interest in art. The bastards. Are they glad to get back at Gale? Are they giving it to him, the lice? Wonder who reminded them of that one."
"I wouldn't know."
"Well, of course, it's just one of those storms in a teacup. They'll forget all about it in a few weeks. I don't think it will do much harm."
"No.
Not this incident alone.
Not by itself."
"Huh? Are you predicting something?"
"Those letters," predicted Alva.
"Not the letters as such,
but that he wouldn't read them."
"Oh, it's no use getting too silly, either. Gale knows where to stop and when. Don't make a mountain out of a mole."
He glanced up at Toohey, and his voice switched to,
"Christ, yes, Ellsworth, you're right. What are we going to do?"
"Nothing, my friend. Nothing. Not for a long time yet."
Toohey sat down on the edge of Skerritt's desk and let the tip of his pointed shoe play among the envelopes in the hamper, tossing them up, making them rustle. He had acquired a pleasant habit of dropping in and out of Skerritt's office at all hours. Skerritt had come to depend on him.
"Say, Ellsworth," Skerritt asked suddenly, "are you really loyal to the Banner?"
"Alva, don't talk in dialect. Nobody's really that stuffy."
"No, I mean it." "Well, you know what I mean."
"Haven't the faintest idea. Who's ever disloyal to his bread and butter?"
"Yeah, that's so." "Still, you know, Ellsworth, I like you a lot. Only I'm never sure when you're just talking my language or when it's really yours."
"Don't go getting yourself into psychological complexities. You'll get all tangled up. What's on your mind?"
"Why do you still write for the New Frontiers?"
"For money."
"Oh, come on, that's chicken feed to you."
"Well, it's a prestige magazine. Why shouldn't I write for them? You haven't got an exclusive on me."
"No, and I don't care who you write for on the side, but the New Frontiers has been damn funny lately."
"About what?"
"About Gail Winand."
"Oh, rubbish, Alva."
"No, sir, this isn't rubbish. You just haven't noticed. Guess you don't read it close enough. But I've got an instinct about things like that, and I know. I know when it's just some smart young punk taking pot shots, or when a magazine means business."
"You're nervous, Alva. And you're exaggerating. The New Frontiers is a liberal magazine, and they've always sniped at Gale Winand. Everybody has. He's never been any too popular in the trade, you know. Hasn't hurt him, though, has it?"
"This is different. I don't like it when there's a system behind it, a kind of special purpose, like a lot of little trickles dribbling along all innocently, and pretty soon they make a little stream, and it all fits pat, and pretty soon..."
"Getting a persecution mania, Alva."
"I don't like it. It was all right when people took cracks at his yachts and women and a few municipal election scandals, which were never proved," he added hastily.
but I don't like it when it's that new intelligentsia slang that people seem to be going for nowadays. Gail Winand, the exploiter. Gail Winand, the pirate of capitalism. Gail Winand, the disease of an era. It's still crap, Ellsworth. Only there's dynamite in that kind of crap.
It's just the modern way of saying the same old things, nothing more. Besides, I can't be responsible for the policy of a magazine just because I sell them an article once in a while.
Yeah, but that's not what I hear.
What do you hear?
I hear you're financing the damn thing.
Who, me? With what?
Well, not you yourself, exactly. But I hear it was you who got young Ronnie Pickering, the booze hound, to give them a shot in the arm to the tune of 100,000 smackers, just about when New Frontiers was going the way of all frontiers.
Hell, that was just to save Ronnie from the town's most expensive gutters. The kid was going to the dogs. Gave him a sort of higher purpose in life. And put 100,000 smackers to better use than the chorus cuties who'd have got it out of him anyway.
Yeah. But you could have attached a little string to the gift. Slipped word to the editors that they'd better lay off Gail or else.
The New Frontiers is not the Banner, Alva. It's a magazine of principles. One doesn't attach strings to its editors, and one doesn't tell them or else.
In this game, Ellsworth? Whom are you kidding?
Well, if it will set your mind at rest, I'll tell you something you haven't heard. It's not supposed to be known. It was done through a lot of proxies. Did you know that I got Mitchell Layton to buy a nice fat chunk of the Banner?
No.
Yes.
Christ, Ellsworth, that's great. Mitchell Layton? We can use a reservoir like that and... Wait a minute. Mitchell Layton?
Yes. What's wrong with Mitchell Layton?
Isn't he the little boy who couldn't digest Grandpa's money?
Grandpa left him an awful lot of money.
Yeah, but he's a crackpot. He's the one who's been a yogi, then a vegetarian, then a Unitarian, then a nudist. And now he's gone to build a palace of the proletariat in Moscow.
So what?
But Jesus. A red among our stockholders?
Mitch isn't a red. How can one be a red with a quarter of $1 billion? He's just a pale tea rose. Mostly yellow. But a nice kid at heart.
But on the Banner?
Alva, you're an ass. Don't you see, I've made him put some dough into a good, solid, conservative paper that'll cure him of his pink notions and set him in the right direction. Besides, what harm can he do? Your dear Gail controls his papers, doesn't he?
Does Gail know about this?
No. Dear Gail hasn't been as watchful in the last 5 years as he used to be, and you'd better not tell him. You see the way Gail's going. He'll need a little pressure, and you'll need the dough. Be nice to Mitch Layton. He can come in handy.
That's so.
It is. You see, my heart's in the right place. I've helped a puny little liberal mag like the New Frontiers, but I've also brought a much more substantial hunk of cash to a big stronghold of arch-conservatism, such as the New York Banner.
So you have. Damn decent of you, too, considering that you're a kind of radical yourself.
Now, are you going to talk about any disloyalty?
Guess not. Guess you'll stand by the old Banner?
Of course I will. Why, I love the Banner. I'd do anything for it. Why, I'd give my life for the New York Banner.
Chapter 8. Walking the soil of a desert island holds one anchored to the rest of the earth. But in their penthouse, with the telephone disconnected, Winand and Dominique had no feeling of the 57 floors below them, of steel shafts braced against granite, and it seemed to them that their home was anchored in space, not an island, but a planet. The city became a friendly sight, an abstraction with which no possible communication could be established, like the sky, a spectacle to be admired, but of no direct concern in their lives. For 2 weeks after their wedding, they never left the penthouse. She could have pressed the button of the elevator and broken these weeks any time she wished. She did not wish it. She had no desire to resist, to wonder, to question. It was enchantment and peace. He sat talking to her for hours when she wanted. He was content to sit silently when she preferred, and look at her, as he looked at the objects in his art gallery, with the same distant, undisturbing glance. He answered any question she put to him. He never asked questions. He never spoke of what he felt. When she wished to be alone,
He did not call for her. One evening she sat reading in her room and saw him standing at the frozen parapet of the dark roof garden outside, not looking back at the house, only standing in the streak of light from her window. When the 2 weeks ended, he went back to his work, to the office of the Banner. But the sense of isolation remained, like a theme declared and to be preserved through all their future days. He came home in the evening, and the city ceased to exist. He had no desire to go anywhere. He invited no guests. He never mentioned it, but she knew that he did not want her to step out of the house, neither with him nor alone. It was a quiet obsession, which he did not expect to enforce. When he came home, he asked, "Have you been out?" "Never. Where have you been?" It was not jealousy. The where did not matter. When she wanted to buy a pair of shoes, he had 3 stores send a collection of shoes for her choice. It prevented her visit to a store. When she said she wanted to see a certain picture, he had a projection room built on the roof. She obeyed for the first few months. When she realized that she loved their isolation, she broke it at once. She made him accept invitations, and she invited guests to their home. He complied without protest. But he maintained a wall she could not break. The wall he had erected between his wife and his newspapers. Her name never appeared in their pages. He stopped every attempt to draw Mrs. Gail Winand into public life, to head committees, sponsor charity drives, endorse crusades. He did not hesitate to open her mail, if it bore an official letterhead that betrayed its purpose, to destroy it without answer, and to tell her that he had destroyed it. She shrugged and said nothing. Yet he did not seem to share her contempt for his papers. He did not allow her to discuss them. She could not discover what he thought of them, nor what he felt. Once, when she commented on an offensive editorial, he said coldly, "I've never apologized for the Banner. I never will." "But this is really awful, Gail. I thought you married me as the publisher of the Banner." "I thought you didn't like to think of that." "What I like or dislike doesn't concern you. Don't expect me to change the Banner or sacrifice it. I wouldn't do that for anyone on earth." She laughed. "I wouldn't ask it, Gail." He did not laugh in answer. In his office in the Banner building, he worked with a new energy, a kind of elated, ferocious drive that surprised the men who had known him in his most ambitious years. He stayed in the office all night when necessary, as he had not done for a long time. Nothing changed in his methods and policy. Alva Skerritt watched him with satisfaction. "We were wrong about him, Ellsworth," said Skerritt to his constant companion. "It's the same old Gale, God bless him. Better than ever."
"My dear Alva," said Toohey, "nothing is ever as simple as you think, nor as fast."
"But he's happy. Don't you see that he's happy?"
"To be happy is the most dangerous thing that could have happened to him. And as a humanitarian, for once, I mean this for his own sake."
Sally Brent decided to outwit her boss. Sally Brent was one of the proudest possessions of the Banner, a stout middle-aged woman who dressed like a model for a style show of the 21st century and wrote like a chambermaid. She had a large personal following among the readers of the Banner. Her popularity made her overconfident. Sally Brent decided to do a story on Mrs. Gail Winand. It was just her type of story, and there it was, simply going to waste. She gained admittance to Winand's penthouse, using the tactics of gaining admittance to places where one is not wanted, which she had been taught as a well-trained Winand employee. She made her usual dramatic entrance, wearing a black dress with a fresh sunflower on her shoulder, her constant ornament that had become a personal trademark. And she said to Dominique breathlessly, "Mrs. Winand, I've come here to help you deceive your husband." Then she winked at her own naughtiness and explained, "Our dear Mr. Winand has been unfair to you, my dear, depriving you of your rightful fame for some reason which I just simply can't understand. But we'll fix him, you and I. What can a man do when we girls get together? He simply doesn't know what good copy you are. So just give me your story and I'll write it, and it will be so good that he just simply won't be able not to run it." Dominique was alone at home, and she smiled in a manner which Sally Brent had never seen before, so the right adjectives did not occur to Sally's usually observant mind. Dominique gave her the story. She gave the exact kind of story Sally had dreamed about. "Yes, of course I cook his breakfast," said Dominique. Ham and eggs is his favorite dish, just plain ham and eggs. Oh, yes, Miss Brent, I'm very happy. I open my eyes in the morning and I say to myself, it can't be true. It's not poor little me who's become the wife of the great Gale Winand, who had all the glamorous beauties of the world to choose from. You see, I've been in love with him for years. He was just a dream to me, a beautiful, impossible dream. And now it's like a dream come true. Please, Miss Brent, take this message from me to the women of America. Patience is always rewarded, and romance is just around the corner. I think it's a beautiful thought, and perhaps it will help other girls, as it has helped me. Yes, all I want of life is to make Gale happy, to share his joys and sorrows, to be a good wife and mother.
Alva Skerritt read the story and liked it so much that he lost all caution.
Run it off, Alva, Sally Brent urged him. Just have a proof run off and leave it on his desk. He'll okay it, see if he won't.
That evening, Sally Brent was fired. Her costly contract was bought off. It had 3 more years to run, and she was told never to enter the Banner building again for any purpose whatsoever. Skerritt protested in panic.
Gale, you can't fire Sally. Not Sally.
When I can't fire anyone I wish on my paper, I'll close it and blow up the goddamn building, said Winand calmly.
But her public will lose her public.
To hell with her public. That night at dinner, Winand took from his pocket a crumpled wad of paper, the proof cut of the story, and threw it without a word at Dominique's face across the table. It hit her cheek and fell to the floor. She picked it up, unrolled it, saw what it was, and laughed aloud. Sally Brent wrote an article on Gale Winand's love life. In a gay, intellectual manner, in the terms of a sociological study, the article presented material such as no pulp magazine would have accepted. It was published in the New Frontiers. Winand brought Dominique a necklace designed at his special order. It was made of diamonds without visible settings, spaced wide apart in an irregular pattern, like a handful scattered accidentally, held together by platinum chains made under a microscope, barely noticeable. When he clasped it about her neck, it looked like drops of water fallen at random. She stood before a mirror. She slipped her dressing gown off her shoulders and let the raindrops glitter on her skin. She said, "That life story of the Bronx housewife who murdered her husband's young mistress is pretty sordid, Gale. But I think there's something dirtier. The curiosity of the people who pander to that curiosity. Actually, it was that housewife. She has piano legs and such a baggy neck in her pictures. Who made this necklace possible? It's a beautiful necklace. I shall be proud to wear it." He smiled. The sudden brightness of his eyes had an odd quality of courage. "That's one way of looking at it," he said. "There's another. I like to think that I took the worst refuse of the human spirit, the mind of that housewife and the minds of the people who like to read about her, and I made of it this necklace on your shoulders. I like to think that I was an alchemist capable of performing so great a purification." She saw no apology, no regret, no resentment as he looked at her. It was a strange glance. She had noticed it before, a glance of simple worship. And it made her realize that there is a stage of worship which makes the worshipper himself an object of reverence. She was sitting before her mirror when he entered her dressing room on the following night. He bent down, he pressed his lips to the back of her neck, and he saw a square of paper attached to the corner of her mirror. It was the decoded copy of the cablegram that had ended her career on the Banner. "Fire the bitch. G.W." He lifted his shoulders to stand erect behind her. He asked, "How did you get that?"
"Ellsworth, too, he gave it to me. I thought it was worth preserving. Of course, I didn't know it would ever become so appropriate."
He inclined his head gravely, acknowledging the authorship, and said nothing else. She expected to find the cablegram gone next morning, but he had not touched it. She would not remove it. It remained displayed on the corner of her mirror. When he held her in his arms, she often saw his eyes move to that square of paper. She could not tell what he thought. In the spring, a publisher's convention took him away from New York for a week. It was their first separation. Dominique surprised him by coming to meet him at the airport when he returned. She was gay and gentle.
Her manner held a promise he had never expected, could not trust, and found himself trusting completely. When he entered the drawing room of their penthouse and slumped down, half-stretching on the couch, she knew that he wanted to lie still here, to feel the recaptured safety of his own world. She saw his eyes open, delivered to her, without defense. She stood straight, ready. She said, "You'd better dress, Gale. We're going to the theater tonight." He lifted himself to a sitting posture. He smiled, the slanting ridges standing out on his forehead. She had a cold feeling of admiration for him. The control was perfect. All but these ridges. He said, "Fine. Black tie or white?"
"White. I have tickets for No Skin Off Your Nose. They were very hard to get."
It was too much. It seemed too ludicrous to be part of this moment's contest between them. He broke down by laughing, frankly, in helpless disgust.
"Good God, Dominique, not that one."
"Why, Gale, it's the biggest hit in town. Your own critic, Jules Fogler."
He stopped laughing. He understood. Said it was the greatest play of our age. Ellsworth, too, he said it was the fresh voice of the coming new world. Alva Skerritt said it was not written in ink, but in the milk of human kindness. Sally Brent, before you fired her, said it made her laugh with a lump in her throat. "Why, it's the godchild of the Banner. I thought you would certainly want to see it."
"Yes, of course," he said.
He got up and went to dress. No Skin Off Your Nose had been running for many months. Ellsworth Toohey had mentioned regretfully in his column that the title of the play had had to be changed slightly, as a concession to the stuffy prudery of the middle class which still controls our theater. It is a crying example of interference with the freedom of the artist. Now, don't let's hear any more of that old twaddle about ours being a free society. Originally, the title of this beautiful play was an authentic line drawn from the language of the people, with the brave, simple eloquence of folk expression. Wynant and Dominique sat in the center of the fourth row, not looking at each other, listening to the play. The things being done on the stage were merely trite and crass, but the undercurrent made them frightening. There was an air about the ponderous inanities spoken, which the actors had absorbed like an infection. It was in their smirking faces, in the slyness of their voices, in their untidy gestures. It was an air of inanities uttered as revelations, and insolently demanding acceptance as such. An air, not of innocent presumption, but of conscious effrontery, as if the author knew the nature of his work, and boasted of his power to make it appear sublime in the minds of his audience, and thus destroy the capacity for the sublime within them. The work justified the verdict of its sponsors. It brought laughs. It was amusing. It was an indecent joke, acted out not on the stage, but in the audience. It was a pedestal from which a god had been torn, and in his place there stood, not Satan with a sword, but a corner lout sipping a bottle of Coca-Cola. There was silence in the audience, puzzled and humble. When someone laughed, the rest joined in with relief, glad to learn that they were enjoying themselves. Jules Fogler had not tried to influence anybody. He had merely made clear, well in advance and through many channels, that anyone unable to enjoy this play was basically a worthless human being.
"It's no use asking for explanations," he had said. "Either you're fine enough to like it, or you aren't."
In the intermission, Wynand heard a stout woman saying, "It's wonderful. I don't understand it, but I have the feeling that it's something very important." Dominique asked him, "Do you wish to go, Gale?" He said,
"No. We'll stay to the end."
He was silent in the car on their way home. When they entered their drawing room, he stood waiting, ready to hear and accept anything. For a moment she felt the desire to spare him. She felt empty and very tired. She did not want to hurt him. She wanted to seek his help. Then she thought again what she had thought in the theater. She thought that this play was the creation of the Banner. This was what the Banner had forced into life, had fed, upheld, made to triumph. And it was the Banner that had begun and ended the destruction of the Stoddard Temple. The New York Banner, November 2nd, 1930. One Small Voice, Sacrilege by Ellsworth M. Toohey, The Churches of Our Childhood by Alva Skerritt. Are you happy, Mr. Superman? And now that the destruction was not an event long since past, this was not a comparison between two mutually unmeasurable entities, a building and a play. It was not an accident, nor a matter of persons, of Ike, Fogler, Toohey, herself, and Rourke. It was a contest without time, a struggle of two abstractions, the thing that had created the building against the things that made the play possible. Two forces suddenly naked to her in their simple statement, two forces that had fought since the world began, and every religion had known of them, and there had always been a god and a devil. Only men had been so mistaken about the shapes of their devil. He was not single and big. He was many and smutty and small. The banner had destroyed the Stoddard Temple in order to make room for this play. It could not do otherwise. There was no middle choice, no escape, no neutrality. It was one or the other. It had always been. And the contest had many symbols, but no name and no statement. Rourke, she heard herself screaming inside. Rourke, Rourke, Rourke. Dominique, what's the matter? She heard Winan's voice. It was soft and anxious. He had never allowed himself to betray anxiety. She grasped the sound as a reflection of her own face, of what he had seen in her face. She stood straight and sure of herself, and very silent inside. I'm thinking of you, Gale, she said. He waited. Well, Gale? The total passion for the total height? She laughed, letting her arms swing sloppily in the manner of the actors they had seen. Say, Gale, have you got a 2-cent stamp with a picture of George Washington on it? How old are you, Gale? How hard have you worked? Your life is more than half over, but you've seen your reward tonight, your crowning achievement. Of course, no man is ever quite equal to his highest passion. Now, if you strive and make a great effort, some day you'll rise to the level of that play. He stood quietly, hearing it, accepting. I think you should take a manuscript of that play and place it on a stand in the center of your gallery downstairs. I think you should rechristen your yacht and call her No Skin Off Your Nose. I think you should take me,
keep still,
and put me in the cast. And make me play the role of Mary every evening. Mary, who adopts the homeless muskrat. And,
Dominique, keep still.
Then talk. I want to hear you talk.
I've never justified myself to anyone.
Well, boast, then. That would do just as well.
If you want to hear it, it made me sick, that play, as you knew it would. That was worse than The Bronx Housewife.
Much worse.
But I can think of something worse still. Writing a great play, and offering it for tonight's audience to laugh at. Letting oneself be martyred by the kind of people we saw frolicking tonight.
He saw that something had reached her. He could not tell whether it was an answer of surprise or of anger. He did not know how well she recognized these words. He went on.
It did make me sick. But so of a great many things which the banner has done. It was worse tonight because there was a quality about it that went beyond the usual. A special kind of malice. But if this is popular with fools, it's the banner's legitimate province. The banner was created for the benefit of fools. What else do you want me to admit?
What you felt tonight.
A minor kind of hell, because you sat there with me. That's what you wanted, wasn't it? To make me feel the contrast. Still, you miscalculated. I looked at the stage and I thought, this is what people are like. Such are their spirits. But I found you. I have you. And the contrast was worth the pain. I did suffer tonight as you wanted. But it was a pain that went only down to a certain point. And then,
shut up, she screamed. Shut up, God damn you.
They stood for a moment, both astonished.
He moved first. He knew she needed his help. He grasped her shoulders. She tore herself away. She walked across the room to the window. She stood looking at the city, at the great buildings spread in black and fire below her. After a while, she said, her voice toneless.
I'm sorry, Gale.
He did not answer.
I had no right to say those things to you.
She did not turn, her arms raised, holding the frame of the window.
We're even, Gale. I'm paid back if that will make it better for you. I broke first.
I don't want you to be paid back.
He spoke quietly.
Dominique, what was it?
Nothing.
What did I make you think of? It wasn't what I said, it was something else. What did the words mean to you?
Nothing.
A pain that went only down to a certain point. It was that sentence. Why?
She was looking at the city. In the distance, she could see the shaft of the Cord building.
Dominique, I've seen what you can take. It must be something very terrible if it could do that to you. I must know. There's nothing impossible. I can help you against it, whatever it is.
She did not answer.
At the theater, it was not just that fool play. There was something else for you tonight. I saw your face. And then it was the same thing again here. What is it?
Gale, she said softly. Will you forgive me?
He let a moment pass. He had not been prepared for that.
What have I to forgive you?
Everything. And tonight,
that was your privilege, the condition on which you married me, to make me pay for the banner.
I don't want to make you pay for it.
Why don't you want it anymore?
It can't be paid for.
In the silence, she listened to his steps pacing the room behind her.
Dominique, what was it?
The pain that stops at a certain point? Nothing.
Only that you had no right to say it.
The men who have pay for that right, a price you can't afford.
But it doesn't matter now. Say it if you wish.
I have no right to say it either.
That wasn't all.
I think we have a great deal in common, you and I. We've committed the same treason somewhere. No, that's a bad word. Yes, I think it's the right word. It's the only one that has the feeling of what I mean.
Dominique, you can't feel that.
His voice sounded strange. She turned to him.
Why?
Because that's what I felt tonight. Treason.
Toward whom?
I don't know. If I were religious, I'd say God, but I'm not religious.
That's what I meant, Gale.
Why should you feel it? The banner is not your child.
There are other forms of the same guilt.
Then he walked to her across the long room. He held her in his arms. He said,
"You don't know the meaning of the kind of words you use. We have a great deal in common, but not that. I'd rather you went on spitting at me than trying to share my offenses."
She let her hand rest against the length of his cheek, her fingertips at his temple. He asked,
"Will you tell me, now, what it was?"
"Nothing. I undertook more than I could carry." "You're tired, Gale. Why don't you go on upstairs? Leave me here for a little while. I just want to look at the city." "Then I'll join you, and I'll be all right."
Chapter 9. Dominique stood at the rail of the yacht, the deck warm under her flat sandals, the sun on her bare legs, the wind blowing her thin white dress. She looked at Wynand, stretched in a deck chair before her. She thought of the change she noticed in him again aboard ship. She had watched him through the months of their summer cruise. She had seen him once running down a companionway. The picture remained in her mind, a tall white figure thrown forward in a streak of speed and confidence. His hand grasped a railing, risking deliberately the danger of a sudden break, gaining a new propulsion. He was not the corrupt publisher of a popular empire. He was an aristocrat aboard a yacht. He looked, she thought, like what one believes aristocracy to be when one is young, a brilliant kind of gaiety without guilt. She looked at him in the deck chair. She thought that relaxation was attractive only in those for whom it was an unusual state. Then even limpness acquired purpose. She wondered about him. Gale Wynand, famous for his extraordinary capacity,
But this was not merely the force of an ambitious adventurer who had created a chain of newspapers. This, the quality she saw in him here, the thing stretched out under the sun like an answer, this was greater, a first cause, a faculty out of universal dynamics.
"Gale," she said suddenly, involuntarily. He opened his eyes to look at her.
"I wish I had taken a recording of that," he said lazily. "You'd be startled to hear what it sounded like. Quite wasted here. I'd like to play it back in a bedroom."
"I'll repeat it there if you wish."
"Thank you, dearest. And I promise not to exaggerate or presume too much. You're not in love with me. You've never loved anyone."
"Why do you think that?"
"If you loved a man, it wouldn't be just a matter of a circus wedding and an atrocious evening in the theater. You'd put him through total hell."
"How do you know that, Gale?"
"Why have you been staring at me ever since we met?" "Because I'm not the Gale Winand you'd heard about. You see, I love you, and love is exception-making. If you were in love, you'd want to be broken, trampled, ordered, dominated, because that's the impossible, the inconceivable for you in your relations with people. That would be the one gift, the great exception you'd want to offer the man you loved. But it wouldn't be easy for you."
"If that's true, then you..."
"Then I become gentle and humble, to your great astonishment, because I'm the worst scoundrel living."
"I don't believe that, Gale."
"No? I'm not the person before last anymore?"
"Not anymore."
"Well, dearest, as a matter of fact, I am."
"Why do you want to think that?"
"I don't want to, but I like to be honest. That has been my only private luxury. Don't change your mind about me. Go on seeing me as you saw me before we met."
"Gale, that's not what you want."
"It doesn't matter what I want. I don't want anything, except to own you. Without answer from you. It has to be without answer. If you begin to look at me too closely, you'll see things you won't like at all."
"What things?"
"You're so beautiful, Dominique. It's such a lovely accident on God's part that there's one person who matches inside and out."
"What things, Gale?"
"Do you know what you're actually in love with?" "Integrity. The impossible. The clean, consistent, reasonable, self-faithful. The all of one style, like a work of art. That's the only field where it can be found, art. But you want it in the flesh. You're in love with it." "Well, you see, I've never had any integrity."
"How sure are you of that, Gale?"
"Have you forgotten the banner?"
"To hell with the banner."
"All right, to hell with the banner. It's nice to hear you say that. But the banner's not the major symptom. That I've never practiced any sort of integrity is not so important. What's important is that I've never felt any need for it. I hate the conception of it. I hate the presumptuousness of the idea."
"Dwight Carson," she said. He heard the sound of disgust in her voice.
He laughed. "Yes, Dwight Carson, the man I bought. The individualist who's become a mob glorifier, and incidentally a dipsomaniac. I did that." "That was worse than the banner, wasn't it?" "You don't like to be reminded of that?"
"No."
"But surely you've heard enough screaming about it. All the giants of the spirit whom I've broken. I don't think anybody ever realized how much I enjoyed doing it. It's a kind of lust. I'm perfectly indifferent to slugs like Ellsworth Toohey or my friend Alva, and quite willing to leave them in peace. But just let me see a man of a slightly higher dimension, and I've got to make a sort of Toohey out of him. I've got to. It's like a sex urge."
"Why?"
"I don't know."
"Incidentally, you misunderstand Ellsworth Toohey."
"Possibly. You don't expect me to waste mental effort to untangle that snail's shell."
"And you contradict yourself."
"Where?"
"Why didn't you set out to destroy me?"
"The exception-making, Dominique. I love you. I had to love you. God help you if you were a man."
"Gale, why?"
"Why have I done all that?"
"Yes."
"Power, Dominique. The only thing I ever wanted, to know that there's not a man living whom I can't force to do anything, anything I choose. The man I couldn't break would destroy me. But I've spent years finding out how safe I am. They say I have no sense of honor. I've missed something in life. Well, I haven't missed very much, have I?
The thing I've missed? It doesn't exist.
He spoke in a normal tone of voice, but he noticed suddenly that she was listening with the intent concentration needed to hear a whisper, of which one can afford to lose no syllable.
What's the matter, Dominique? What are you thinking about?
I'm listening to you, Gail. She did not say she was listening to his words and to the reason behind them. It was suddenly so clear to her that she heard it as an added clause to each sentence, even though he had no knowledge of what he was confessing.
The worst thing about dishonest people is what they think of as honesty, he said. I know a woman who's never held to one conviction for 3 days running, but when I told her she had no integrity, she got very tight-lipped and said her idea of integrity wasn't mine. It seems she'd never stolen any money. Well, she's one that's in no danger from me, whatever. I don't hate her. I hate the impossible conception you love so passionately, Dominique.
Do you?
I've had a lot of fun proving it.
She walked to him and sat down on the deck beside his chair, the planks smooth and hot under her bare legs. He wondered why she looked at him so gently. He frowned. She knew that some reflection of what she had understood remained in her eyes, and she looked away from him.
Gail, why tell me all that? It's not what you want me to think of you.
No, it isn't. Why tell you now? Want the truth?
Because it has to be told. Because I wanted to be honest with you. Only with you and with myself. But I wouldn't have the courage to tell you anywhere else, not at home, not ashore, only here. Because it doesn't seem quite real, does it?
No.
I think I hoped that here you'd accept it, and still think of me as you did when you spoke my name in that way I wanted to record.
She put her head against his chair, her face pressed to his knees, her hands dropped, fingers half curled on the glistening planks of the deck. She did not want to show what she had actually heard him saying about himself today. On a night of late fall, they stood together at the roof garden parapet, looking at the city. The long shafts made of lighted windows were like streams breaking out of the black sky, flowing down in single drops to feed the great pools of fire below.
There they are, Dominique, the great buildings, the skyscrapers. Do you remember? They were the first link between us. We're both in love with them, you and I.
She thought she should resent his right to say it, but she felt no resentment.
Yes, Gail, I'm in love with them.
She looked at the vertical threads of light that were the cord building. She raised her fingers off the parapet, just enough to touch the place of its unseen form on the distant sky. She felt no reproach from it.
I'd like to see a man standing at the foot of a skyscraper. It makes him no bigger than an ant. Isn't that the correct bromide for the occasion? The goddamn fools. It's man who made it. The whole incredible mass of stone and steel, it doesn't dwarf him, it makes him greater than the structure. It reveals his true dimensions to the world. What we love about these buildings, Dominique, is the creative faculty, the heroic in man.
Do you love the heroic in man, Gail?
I love to think of it. I don't believe it.
She leaned against the parapet and watched the green lights stretched in a long straight line far below. She said, I wish I could understand you.
I thought I should be quite obvious. I've never hidden anything from you.
He watched the electric signs that flashed in disciplined spasms over the Black River. Then he pointed to a blurred light far to the south, a faint reflection of blue.
That's the Banner Building. See, over there, that blue light. I've done so many things, but I've missed one, the most important. There's no Winand Building in New York. Someday I'll build a new home for the Banner. It will be the greatest structure of the city, and it will bear my name. I started in a miserable dump, and the paper was called the Gazette. I was only a stooge for some very filthy people. But I thought then of the Winand Building that would rise someday. I've thought of it all the years since.
Why haven't you built it?
I wasn't ready for it.
Why?
I'm not ready for it now. I don't know why. I know only that it's very important to me. It will be the final symbol. I'll know the right time when it comes.
He turned to look out to the west, to a patch of dim, scattered lights. He pointed.
That's where I was born, Hell's Kitchen.
She listened attentively. He seldom spoke of his beginning.
I was 16 when I stood on a roof and looked at the city, like tonight, and decided what I would be.
The quality of his voice became a line underscoring the moment, saying, "Take notice, this is important." Not looking at him, she thought that this was what she had waited for. This should give her the answer, the key to him. Years ago, thinking of Gail Winand, she had wondered how such a man faced his life and his work. She expected boasting and a hidden sense of shame, or impertinence flaunting its own guilt. She looked at him. His head lifted, his eyes level on the sky before him. He conveyed none of the things she had expected. He conveyed a quality incredible in this connection, a sense of gallantry. She knew it was a key, but it made the puzzle greater. Yet something within her understood, knew the use of that key, and made her speak. "Gail, fire Ellsworth Toohey." He turned to her, bewildered.
"Why?"
"Gail, listen." Her voice had an urgency she had never shown in speaking to him. "I've never wanted to stop Toohey. I've even helped him. I thought he was what the world deserved. I haven't tried to save anything from him. Or anyone. I never thought it would be the banner. The banner which he fits best, that I'd want to save from him."
"What on earth are you talking about?"
"Gail, when I married you, I didn't know I'd come to feel this kind of loyalty to you. It contradicts everything I've done. It contradicts so much more than I can tell you. It's a sort of catastrophe for me, a turning point. Don't ask me why. It will take me years to understand. I know only that this is what I owe you. Fire Ellsworth Toohey. Get him out before it's too late. You've broken many much less vicious men and much less dangerous. Fire Toohey. Go after him and don't rest until you've destroyed every last bit of him."
"Why? Why should you think of him just now?"
"Because I know what he's after."
"What is he after?"
"Control of the Winand papers."
He laughed aloud. It was not derision or indignation, just pure gaiety greeting the point of a silly joke.
"Gail," she said helplessly.
"Oh, for God's sake, Dominique, and here I've always respected your judgment."
"You've never understood Toohey."
"And I don't care to. Can you see me going to Ellsworth, Toohey? A tank to eliminate a bedbug? Why should I fire Elsie? He's the kind that makes money for me. People love to read his twaddle. I don't fire good booby traps like that. He's as valuable to me as a piece of flypaper."
"That's the danger." "Part of it."
"His wonderful following. I've had bigger and better sob sisters on my payroll. When a few of them had to be kicked out, that was the end of them. Their popularity stopped at the door of the banner. But the banner went on."
"It's not his popularity. It's the special nature of it. You can't fight him on his terms. You're only a tank, and that's a very clean, innocent weapon. An honest weapon that goes first, out in front, and mows everything down or takes every counterblow. He's a corrosive gas, the kind that eats lungs out. I think there really is a secret to the core of evil, and he has it. I don't know what it is. I know how he uses it and what he's after."
"Control of the Winand papers?"
"Control of the Winand papers. As one of the means to an end."
"What end?"
"Control of the world."
He said with patient disgust. "What is this, Dominique? What sort of gag, and what for?"
"I'm serious, Gail. I'm terribly serious."
"Control of the world, my dear, belongs to men like me. The Toohey's of this earth wouldn't know how to dream about it."
"I'll try to explain. It's very difficult. The hardest thing to explain is the glaringly evident, which everybody has decided not to see. But if you'll listen..."
"I won't listen. You'll forgive me, but discussing the idea of Ellsworth Toohey as a threat to me is ridiculous. Discussing it seriously is offensive."
"Gail, I..."
"No. Darling, I don't think you really understand much about the banner, and I don't want you to. I don't want you to take any part in it. Forget it. Leave the banner to me."
"Is it a demand, Gail?"
It's an ultimatum.
All right.
Forget it. Don't go acquiring horror complexes about anyone as big as Ellsworth Toohey. It's not like you.
All right, Gale. Let's go in. It's too cold for you here without an overcoat.
He chuckled softly. It was the kind of concern she had never shown for him before. He took her hand and kissed her palm, holding it against his face.
For many weeks, when left alone together, they spoke little, and never about each other. But it was not a silence of resentment. It was the silence of an understanding too delicate to limit by words. They would be in a room together in the evening, saying nothing, content to feel each other's presence. They would look at each other suddenly, and both would smile, the smile like hands clasped. Then one evening, she knew he would speak. She sat at her dressing table. He came in and leaned against the wall beside her. He looked at her hands, at her naked shoulders. But she felt as if he did not see her. He was looking at something greater than the beauty of her body, greater than his love for her. He was looking at himself, and this, she knew, was the one incomparable tribute.
"I breathe for my own necessity, for the fuel of my body, for my survival. I've given you not my sacrifice or my pity, but my ego, and my naked need."
She heard Rourke's words, Rourke's voice, speaking for Gale Wynand. And she felt no sense of treason to Rourke in using the words of his love for the love of another man. "Gale," she said gently, "someday I'll have to ask your forgiveness for having married you."
He shook his head slowly, smiling.
She said, "I wanted you to be my chain to the world. You've become my defense instead, and that makes my marriage dishonest."
"No. I told you I would accept any reason you chose."
"But you've changed everything for me." "Or was it I that changed it? I don't know. We've done something strange to each other. I've given you what I wanted to lose, that special sense of living I thought this marriage would destroy for me, the sense of life as exaltation. And you've done all the things I would have done. Do you know how much alike we are?"
"I knew that from the first."
"But it should have been impossible. Gale, I want to remain with you now. For another reason. To wait for an answer. I think when I learn to understand what you are, I'll understand myself. There is an answer. There is a name for the thing we have in common. I don't know it. I know it's very important."
"Probably. I suppose I should want to understand it, but I don't. I can't care about anything now. I can't even be afraid."
She looked up at him and said very calmly, "I am afraid, Gale."
"Of what, dearest?"
"Of what I'm doing to you."
"Why?"
"I don't love you, Gale."
"I can't care even about that."
She dropped her head, and he looked down at the hair that was like a pale helmet of polished metal.
"Dominique."
She raised her face to him obediently.
"I love you, Dominique. I love you so much that nothing can matter to me, not even you. Can you understand that? Only my love, not your answer."